By whose authority?
Story goes that there was a young man who was an avid golfer, and he found himself with a few hours of spare hours one afternoon where he could run out and play a few holes. He figured if he played quickly enough, he could get in maybe 9 holes before it got too dark and he had to head home. Just as he was about to tee off, an elderly gentleman shuffled up to the tee and asked if he could play along. Not being able to say no by golf course etiquette, I guess, he allowed the older gentleman to join him. And to his surprise, the older gentleman played very quickly the game. Now, he didn't hit the ball far, but he plodded along consistently and didn't waste any time at all. Finally, they reached the 9th fairway, and the young man found himself in a very difficult spot, a difficult shot. There was a large pine tree directly in front of him, and it was between his ball and the green. Now, after several minutes of watching the young man debate how he would take that shot, the older gentleman finally said, "You know, when I was your age, I hit the ball right over that tree." Well, with that challenge placed before him, the young man swung hard, hit the ball up and right smack at the top of the tree trunk. It thudded to the ground, not a foot from the original spot. The old man offered one more comment. "Of course, when I was your age, that pine tree was only 3 feet tall." It's a good story, eh? You know, every one of us in this room have had moments in our lives when we've really regretted taking the advice of someone else. Sometimes the erroneous advice has just an irritating consequence, like that young man who experienced that playing golf. Other times, however, bad advice can cause us a great deal of harm. For example, you get a phone call from your broker telling you, "Hey, I've got a great stock market opportunity for you." And so you buy thousands of dollars worth of shares only for the company that you bought shares in to do something foolish, or the economy collapses, and there goes a lot of money. Perhaps you've had the terrifying experience of having your doctor prescribe medication it's designed to help you. Been there, done that. Only to discover that you react badly to that medication and the side effects are brutal. You know, I don't know if you've discovered this, but it's hard to trust advice, isn't it? Even when the advice is coming from the so-called experts. However, we are a people with itchy ears. We long to hear what we want to hear, even if what we hear is not the truth. There's a wonderful story, interesting chapter in the life of the prophet Jeremiah, chapter 29 to be exact, if you ever want to look it up. And this story demonstrates our reluctance to accept the truth. Jeremiah had sent a letter to Shemaiah, who was living in exile in Babylon, telling him that God had said that the people of Israel should prepare for a very long exile in Babylon. Jeremiah told him that God had decided to keep the people there for many years. They should build houses, they should plant trees, they should cultivate fields. Shemaiah was outraged. He didn't want to hear such talk. Surely God would bring them back home sooner than that. So Shemaiah wrote a nasty letter to Zephaniah the high priest. He demanded that Jeremiah be arrested for writing such a letter. In turn, God gives a message to Jeremiah that Shemaiah is spreading lies, saying the exile will, and Shemaiah's lie is that the exile will be brief, but it's not going to be brief, God said, and therefore God will punish Shemaiah. You see, Jeremiah had authority because God gave it to him. Shemaiah did not, because God hadn't given him any. The point is that even with God's given authority, Jeremiah's message to the people who were in exile was not accepted. They didn't want to hear it. The bad news was not wanted, even if it was true. Enter then, if you will, our gospel lesson for today. The setting of this passage occurs the day after Jesus had cleared the money changers from the temple. Remember that story? He takes that whip and or cords and drives them out. And also that Jesus had just done a whole bunch of powerful demonstrations of God's mercy by healing a number of sick people. The crowds watching all of this were just so overcome by Jesus' actions that even little children began to praise him, saying, "Praise God for the Son of God," or Son of David, excuse me. The religious leaders of the day, they were indignant. Actually, that's a very mild way of expressing it. These community and religious powerhouses were so angry to the point of trying to dispose of Jesus. Why? Why did they hate Jesus so much? Could they not see what he was doing in their midst? Well, actually, they did see. And that's why they were so angry. Because they could see all the good things that Jesus was doing, and they saw the huge crowds that followed him and praised him. They were angry because Jesus was the center of attention, and they were not. People were talking about Jesus, as Matthew 21, 11, or 10 to 11 indicates, they were talking about Jesus, but not the Pharisees and scribes and the priests. The whole city was just buzzing with excitement about Jesus' arrival. Also burning the britches of the religious elite was the fact that people, when they talked about religious matters, they quoted Jesus, not members of the Sanhedrin or what is commonly referred to as the religious court. The revival of religious fervor originated not from their highly polished and heavily promoted religion, but from Jesus' acts of grace and mercy. They were frankly jealous. They wanted the attention. They wanted people to sing praises about them and hang on to their every word. Their influence was being dismissed and diminished, and it irked them. The religious leaders must have spent hours debating not only what Jesus said and did, but more significantly for today, what authority he had to be doing his ministry. It's a funny thing, isn't it? Nothing really ever changes with people. You see, even today we are constantly questioning authority, you and I. In fact, maybe we question authority more today than we ever have in the history of humanity. It used to be that whenever a teacher or a parent or a politician or a minister said something, that carried weight with us. Not anymore. Today, most modern people believe they are their own arbiters of truth. How many times have we heard when we're talking to a friend, someone say, "Oh, you just don't understand," or, "What gives you the right?" I'm sure you've heard this expression. I did as a kid growing up. "Who died and made you king or queen," as the case may be. Remember that? We are doubting the truthfulness of almost every authority figure in our culture, in our society, because we believe that for the most part, they care only about themselves, right? Never is this more clearly demonstrated than during an election campaign, right? We're very cynical about our political system. I once came across a beautiful editorial cartoon that captures our cynicism quite well. It was the picture of a grandmother with her grandchild on her lap reading a children's book. And the child says, "Grandma, do all fairy tales begin with once upon a time?" The grandmother replied, "No, dear, sometimes they begin with, if I'm elected, I promise to." In Jesus' case, the religious leaders were angry because they were the duly appointed authority on matters of faith. After all, it was they who had done all that studying, they had done all that training, and they had put their time into being in that position of authority. After all, how did Jesus gain his position? Who was his teacher or his mentor? Where did he train? He is, after all, as was told to him many times, he's just the son of a carpenter. Or actually, the word is laborer. He came from, of all places, Nazareth. What gives Jesus the right to clear the temple, to heal the sick, to make comments on religious matters? This question of authority is at the very core of the religious leaders' objections to Jesus. He was intruding on their territory, and they didn't like it one bit. So this time, they decide they're going to go right to the heart of the matter. They stand in front of him and confront him with a question: by whose authority did you drive out the merchants from the temple? Who gave you such authority? What they wanted Jesus to publicly admit that he thought God had given him the authority, and thus they could charge him with blasphemy and maybe turn the crowd against Jesus and then give them further cause to destroy him. In very typical rabbinical fashion, however, Jesus answers their question with one of his own. Did John's baptism come from heaven, or was it merely human? Now, Jesus is not trying to avoid the question posed to him by a clever turn of the table, but he's seeking to reveal to the Pharisees themselves that they have unreceptive hearts to God's grace. Now, this new question posed to them begins a debate among the leaders. They kind of huddle up and they begin to talk it out amongst themselves. And they recognize that this is no idle question. They have all been very well trained to know how rabbinical questioning and teaching works. They know what he's doing. If they were to say that John's baptism was from heaven, Jesus will ask them why they didn't believe in John then. If they say that the baptism was from human sources, the crowd would get violent with rage because they revered John. They considered him a prophet. They were caught in their own dilemma of authority. So the only answer they could bring themselves to give was, "We don't know." So Jesus replies, "Then I won't answer your question either." It's interesting, though, that Jesus kind of does answer their question, but in a way they did not expect. He tells a parable. It's another vineyard parable, and it goes straight. And it's really straightforward enough, actually. There was a man who had two sons, and he asked the first to go out and work in his vineyard, but the son refused. Now, I should point out at this point that this refusal of the father's request was so socially unacceptable in Jesus' day. It was a great affront to the father. In a family, the father was the lord and master, and the son's refusal was a great insult. But Jesus goes on to say that later, however, the son, he changed his mind. He repented, in other words, and he went and he worked in the vineyard. Now, the second son receives the same request, and he's all positive about going and working in the vineyard, but he didn't go. He said yes, but his actions revealed his refusal to do what the father requested. Then Jesus asks, pretty obvious question really, to the religious leaders, which of these two sons obeyed the father? Well, the religious leaders answered correctly, the first one. The one who said he would, first refused and then went. The implications for the religious leaders are staggering. You see, the religious leaders are the second son in that parable. The ones who had received the law, they had received the father's demands. These same leaders gave assent to the law. They agreed to try and follow them, but they had not obeyed it. Nor have they responded to John or Jesus, who have tried to lead them back to a right relationship with God the Father. These self-proclaimed faithful religious leaders who have failed to respond to God's call to service. Well, tax collectors and prostitutes who originally refused God have now repented and are seeking to serve him. The sad thing is that the religious leaders truly believed that they were doing the right thing. They were on the right side of this. They believed that their obsession with the minute details of the law, the oppressive interpretations of the law, was what God wanted. But is this what God really wants? Is ritual and religious works what really warms up God's heart? The prophet Hosea's writings include just one of hundreds of verses that speak about what God really wants from his people. Hosea 6:6 reads, I want you to be merciful. I don't want your sacrifices. I want you to know God. That's more important than burnt offering. You know, the religious leaders of the Jesus day were really good at burning up stuff for sacrifices. But they were terrible at showing mercy. In their minds and their hard hearts, they had written off entire groups of people from any place in God's kingdom. The list was actually quite long and included, among others, tax collectors and prostitutes and lepers and those with handicaps and Gentiles and Samaritans. They had claimed to know what God wanted from them, but had failed to go out and show mercy. Instead of being joyful, that Zacchaeus, a son of Abraham, changed his mind about God and wanted to serve him. Instead of celebrating, what did they do? They stood outside of Zacchaeus' house and they grumbled about Jesus having dinner with him. Instead of showing compassion on the woman who broke into Simon the Pharisee's home during a dinner party and poured perfume on Jesus' feet out of gratitude for his love, they grumbled about the impropriety of the woman letting down her hair or wasting money. Instead of recognizing Jesus as the resurrection and the life who could call Lazarus from the dead, they laughed at him. Instead of shouting with joy when the poor man in Matthew 12 with the withered hand was healed, they grumbled because he was healed on the Sabbath. As Greg Rushell points out, isn't it odd that the Pharisees saw healing on the Sabbath as wrong, but plotting Jesus' murder was okay? Instead of opening their hearts to hear what John the Baptist was saying to them in the wilderness, they grumbled about the fact that he was so popular and they were not. So tell me, which brother are you? My greatest fear is that I would be one of those second brothers. That I'd only give lip service to the call of God and not really engage in the work of God. We're always faced with the great danger that we can believe we are good Christian people simply because we say all the right things or defend what we perceive as a proper Christian position on a whole host of social agenda issues. But in the end, words are cheap. Actions are what truly matter. This is, of course, one of the main points of the book of James, isn't it? James 2:17 reads, "So you see, it isn't enough to have faith. Faith that doesn't show itself by good deeds is no faith at all. It is dead and it's useless." The second brother may have said he would do what the father wanted him to do, but he was useless when it came to actually going out and working in the vineyard, wasn't he? What good is our faith if all it amounts to is an hour of worship on Sunday and maybe a few scattered moments of passing along religious sentiment? Well, our neighbors desperately need some mercy. We've been shown the way of life. And it's up to each one of us to follow that way of life. And waste no more time harvesting sour grapes.